Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the COVID-19 outbreak continues. Cases rise, so do deaths here and around the country. An update on the numbers and the disproportional impact of the virus on Mecklenburg's Black residents. Statewide stay-at-home orders go into effect this week. Are people complying? CMS classes have gone online, but the school board has technical issues while holding their first remote board meeting, and job losses are astronomical as the pandemic closes everything, but there are companies hiring, and we'll share what we know about that. Our roundtable of reporters is set to fill us in on those stories and more, and Doss Helms is here. She is our education reporter for WFAE News. Actually, she's there because we're all in our homes today. Good morning, Ann. Welcome.
Good morning.
Katie Peralta is senior editor for the Charlotte Agenda. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Glenn Birkins is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Mike.
Morning. And Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC TV Channel 9 Eyewitness News, who joins us from his remote Channel 9 Eyewitness News set this morning.
Good morning, my Joe. Dining room table. Good morning,
Mike. The number of COVID-19 cases continued to rise here and around the country. 2 weeks ago on this program, we reported that the state was reporting 136 cases. Last week, 667. This morning, 1,946 in 83 counties, with I think 18 deaths. 2 weeks ago, Mecklenburg reported 43 cases. Last week, 204. This morning, 533. And yesterday, our third death was reported in this county. Yesterday, Gaston County confirmed its first death from the virus. And Mecklenburg County Health Director Gibby Harris commented on this rapid increase in local cases this week when she spoke to a legislative health committee. And what she saw last weekend, the first weekend of our county's stay-at-home order, had her frustrated.
Our parks were packed with people. Social distancing was not even an option. Sandbars on the lakes were crowded.
Is it that people are not getting the message, don't believe the message, ignoring the message, not understanding the message? What's going on here?
What Harris has said was that there's just a good chunk of people in Mecklenburg County who feel as if that they don't have to follow this. These rules don't apply to them. And that's what's really frustrated her, is that people don't seem to be having this message click in their minds that, hey, we need to follow these social distancing rules now if we ever want to come on the other side of this. And the quicker we do it, the less time we'll have to have these rules in place.
Because
earlier this week, the County Park and Rec Department began disabling some of the basketball courts that are in the county. There's one near my house, and probably within 5 hours after they had disabled this park, someone had gone through and they had cut the little tie and it was back in business. So I think there is a number of people who just refuse to take this thing seriously.
Yeah, the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, was similarly frustrated. That's why he had all the playgrounds in New York City locked, closed and locked. And he asked on a news conference, don't you understand that you have to follow these orders because you are putting people's lives in danger? Well, last night, county officials sent out a Twitter announcement about this, and they said that the curve will not flatten immediately. We don't expect numbers to drop right away. And here's the shocking part of this. Community spread is here, so assume you're going to be exposed if you're out and about. Assume it. Do you think people believe that?
I think they're starting to, but I think part of what you saw early on was possibly not ill-intentioned or not even reckless, but that thing where you think, well, I'm going stir crazy. They say it's okay to be outside, so I'm going to take my kids to the playground, or I'm going to go take a hike in Crowder's Mountain State Park. And you get there and you realize, oh, wow, everybody else had the same idea. So I think it is starting, as we're seeing these numbers rise, as we're starting to potentially know some people who have got it, even if they haven't had a really bad case, people are saying, oh, this really means me. I have to stay home. But as Glenn said, there will be people who will say, no, this does not mean me.
We are discovering it. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, I think the message is also getting to people now. They're starting to understand that you don't have to be symptomatic in order to have this. And people are starting to realize that, hey, just because you feel fine doesn't mean you don't have it. And now the CDC is even taking another look at requiring people or suggesting that people wear masks outside of their house. I think that will be a wake-up call for a lot of people.
Because we are discovering that it's possibly airborne now, in addition to being on surfaces. And the problem in playgrounds is that if kids are playing and they've been exposed to it, they are leaving the virus on these surfaces, and they can last for hours to days on these surfaces. North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper tried this week to improve on this state's patchwork of stay-at-home orders. Some counties have enacted them, others have not. But on Monday afternoon, they became a statewide requirement.
It's what we have to do to save lives. These are tough directives, but I need you to take them seriously.
As more governors step into the fray and do this, like the Florida governor, I think, just did this very late in the process, are people likely to get the message more solidly that, gosh, everybody's doing this, it must be important?
That's their hope. I mean, as much as they can hammer this into the ground and respond to very specific questions about people, you know, can I shoot hoops? Can I golf? Can I, you know, go to the ABC store? They will continue to issue guidance. And like Joe said about the masks, I think that when people start seeing, you know, sort of this alarming visual of people wearing masks in order to protect themselves and prevent the spread of this thing, maybe they will start to realize, oh, this isn't just, you know, this isn't just a, I don't even know what people think it is, conspiracy, or maybe it's just, it's not like the common cold or whatever, you know, it's right. Much more serious. It is taking lives.
You know, we're not really enforcing this stay-at-home order very stringently. The police department is not, the sheriff's department is not, and I don't think it's being enforced stringently anywhere in the country. I don't think fines are being levied. People are not being put in jail for this. If there was more stringent enforcement, would people be more likely to pay attention?
The one state that I've seen enforce this pretty strongly is New Jersey. I just read an article this morning about 15 people being cited for going to a rabbi's funeral there. But other than that, you're right. The focus really of these law enforcement agencies has been education. And CMPD has gotten hundreds of complaints, and they still haven't cited anybody for violating the stay-at-home.
The state has been I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say that I do think that some people are seeing that, oh, CMPD is just educating people about this. Maybe my risk is not, maybe the risk isn't that great for me to go outside.
The state has been conducting more coronavirus tests, and with those tests, the numbers will continue to rise because we'll discover that more people have it than we thought. As of earlier this week, I believe, Katie, the state had completed 28,679 tests. Do we know how many are coming back positive, how many are coming back negative?
No. Unfortunately, with, you know, private labs and commercial companies doing their own testing, they are only required to report when they have positive tests. So, you know, we might locally have like Atrium and Novant and Trion Medical, for instance, conducting their own tests. They might be doing thousands a day combined, but they don't necessarily have to report every single one that they do. Most are going to come back negative, but at the same time, they will flow that information up to the state when it is positive. I believe, you know, testing is still ramping up. The state has said that repeatedly. That's why numbers will continue to rise. You know, on the surface, it does look pretty alarming. And again, this is a, you know, very scary virus, but at the same time, the more testing we do, the more the cases will rise. And of course, let's not forget that there are thousands of cases or thousands of tests pending throughout the state too.
And we don't know how many people have it, I suppose, because if the numbers are rising as the tests come back, then we have a lot more. I've heard as many as 10 times more cases as the tests would indicate. Mecklenburg Health Director Gibby Harris also shared numbers that indicate, Glenn, a disproportionate number of cases are falling in the Black community. They make up 44% of cases in Mecklenburg, while comprising only 33% of the population. Is this confined to Mecklenburg or to North Carolina, or is this happening all over the country, or do you know?
Yes, there is a growing body of evidence that COVID-19 is affecting communities of color especially Black communities, poorer communities, disproportionate. It's not just here in Mecklenburg. We hear often that this is an equal opportunity virus, and that is certainly true in that anyone can get it and anyone can die for it from it. We've seen Britain's Prince Charles exposed to it, so that's certainly true. But in certain communities, you tend to have more pre-existing conditions. You tend to have more things like asthma, more respiratory problems, more things like diabetes that make some communities much more susceptible to serious illness if they contract COVID-19. And I think, as I said, I think there's a growing body of evidence that is happening, not just here, but elsewhere. We've not gotten numbers from the county in recent days. And I think that's a mistake. It's hard to address an issue that people won't talk about. If we can't talk about it, how can we fix it? There are institutions within the Black community that can help carry the message, churches and other institutions, sororities, fraternities. So far, I've not seen any evidence that the county has enlisted any of those organizations to really address where we're having the greatest need. And I think that's a mistake. I think at some point we may look back and realize that we need to do another commission or some other task force on what we might do better next time instead of being much more proactive this time around.
I want to get back to the fact that this is impacting more people in the Black community here and around the country because, as you point out, access to health care, poverty, underlying conditions that a lot of these people have because of a lack of access to health care and poverty, et cetera, are causing them to have worse effects of getting the virus. But why are more of them contracting the virus?
Well, we don't know for a fact that more of them are contracting the virus because we, as was stated early, we don't have great data in terms of who's being tested, what percentage of each demographic is being tested. So our knowledge is limited to a certain degree. But of those who have tested positive, both here and elsewhere, a disproportionate number of those people have been people of color.
Yeah, the Mecklenburg County Health Department has been reluctant to hand out information about demographics of this disease. At one point, they were giving out information on zip codes. They've stopped doing that because I think Gibby Harris felt that was giving people a false sense of security if they lived in a zip code where the cases were lower than other zip codes. But Joe, in South Carolina, which has been late to the game on closing things, the governor, Henry McMaster, down there is taking that approach, isn't he?
Well, he says that he is ordering DHEC to provide the amount of cases based on local zip codes. But something else that he is doing that I haven't seen anywhere yet is that he wants DHEC to provide the estimated number of residents who are likely infected and untested within that same zip code. I really have no idea how they're going to track that or how they're going to provide that information. So we'll have to see what DHEC comes up with.
Mike, let's look at this a different way. If this were a crime spree, we would have no trouble putting additional resources where the problems are. We should be doing that with this as well.
Okay. When we come back, we'll talk about other things surrounding this health situation, including hospitals requesting field hospitals to be set up in Mecklenburg County. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. Listener support powers the coverage from WFAE that you rely on in good times and bad. As reporters and producers keep you updated on the coronavirus and its impact on the community, we hope that you'll consider a donation to WFAE at WFAE.org or by calling 704-549-9000. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. Ann Doss Helms is here from WFAE News. Our education reporter, Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com, Katie Peralta, senior editor of the Charlotte Agenda, and Joe Bruno, reporter for WSSC-TV Channel 9, Eyewitness News. Gibby Harris shared some good news at her conference this week. 3 out of 4 people, she says, who tested positive for COVID-19 were not hospitalized. 3 out of 4. The State Department of Health reports that 34% of the state's 21,000 hospital beds are empty, and that 20% of the 3,200 intensive care beds are unused. Only 22% of the state's 2,800 ventilators are in use. Those numbers, however, are likely to very quickly change, I would imagine. Aren't they talking about the peak in this area being between April 15th and April 21st? And I think it was yesterday it was announced that both Novant and Atrium have asked officials to set up a field hospital at UNC Charlotte. That does not bode well, it seems to me.
Both of them have said that they have essentially done everything that they can to create space in their respective facilities. For instance, they kind of hit the pause button on non-essential surgeries. So that's a huge way that hospitals make money, by the way, and that's a separate conversation. But they have cleared out patients who are not, you know, suffering, who don't need to be there. They've created a space where they can. I believe Gene Woods said they have kind of looked to every nook and cranny to expand capacity by 50%. And yet they're still going to have a deficit of about 3,000 beds, which is gigantic. Again, we feel like we've been quarantining. We feel like we've been doing this stay-at-home thing for weeks now. And yet both hospital systems say that the worst is actually yet to come. It could be anywhere between mid-April and mid-May. So in anticipation of that, I think that they are kind of bracing for the worst when they project this 3,000 bed number.
And I think one thing we've had trouble with is being able to grasp that there's a threat that we haven't seen yet, that it's going to be really bad. But we now have the advantage, for better or for worse, of looking at New York City or looking at Seattle and realizing you can go from something like we're in now, which is bad but not horrible, to something that's really a huge overflow emergency pretty quickly.
And we keep hearing that from the governor of New York, that what's happening there is going to happen where you are in 2 weeks or 3 weeks or by the end of the month. Other cities, are, including New York, are using arenas and convention centers as field hospitals. In addition to setting up tents outside of hospitals, they're using the Javits Center, the enormous convention center in New York City, for this. We're not going to do that. I read 2 stories about this. I'm not sure which one is the more accurate, that the convention center is under construction and therefore it cannot be used. And the RNC is coming in August, and they don't want to use it because they don't want people to think it's infected. Is that which is the more accurate version of that story? Does anybody know?
I asked the CRVA yesterday if the convention center was being considered at all, and they said you have to refer to the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Joint Information Center. And then when I asked them, they said we are assessing various locations. Okay. So that's the extent that they want to discuss that publicly.
The University of Washington has done COVID-19 projections for our state, and they say that the need here for hospital resources will peak on April 26th, at which time we would face a shortage of 213 intensive care beds and a shortage of 624 ventilators. Some hospitals around the country started using these helmets that you've seen on people in Italy, that simply take the oxygen feed from the wall in your hospital room and feed it into this mask, and that seems to act almost as well as a ventilator in some cases. But some hospitals are running short of oxygen. Do we know what the situation is here? Are they stockpiling it? Okay, we don't know. The projected death toll nationwide is nearly unimaginable. I mean, if we don't follow the guidelines, we're talking about millions of people dying. And if we do follow the guidelines, and by that I mean stay at home when you're told to stay at home, medical experts are saying that there should be around 100,000 to 200 to 250,000 people. A quarter million people will die from this. And projections for this state call for 51 people per day to die here by April 27th. About 1,500 dying by early August. Wow. The economy has been crushed by this pandemic, and this was the week, Katie, that a lot of people began to feel it because the bills came due. Of course, Congress has approved sending these checks of $1,000 to $1,200 or more to people. When will those checks come in?
So the $1,200 checks, again, depend on how much money you make. If you make over, I believe it's $99,000, you will not receive any part of those checks. But I think it was the Washington Post, New York Times reported yesterday that these checks might not come for some people until September, which is far later than probably people hoped. A lot of people don't have the cash in hand to wait till September. The federal government is supposed to get the ball rolling on these checks within a matter of days for the first round of people or for, you know, folks who have direct deposit and things like that. I would assume that a lot of people who desperately need this money might not have direct deposit. They might
and may not file a tax return.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Are these are these checks taxable at some point in the future?
Now, that's a good question. Okay. I don't know the answer to that.
Glenn?
Mike, to put the need for those checks in perspective, the government released its latest unemployment figures this morning. It showed that the economy lost about 700,000 jobs. So we've gone from creating somewhere between 100 and 150,000 to 200,000 jobs per month to losing 700,000. The unemployment rate jumped from 3.4% to, I think, about 4.4 or 4.5, somewhere in that area. The New York Times is projecting that the actual unemployment rate is probably closer to 13%. And the reason that it is showing much lower is that the government collected its data mid-March, which was before most of companies, most of the layoffs, most of the furloughs actually happened. So we're not getting a complete look at the unemployment picture for March, as devastating as it is.
It means that I read yesterday that last year at this time, the number of people filing for unemployment was 211,000. 10 million people have applied for unemployment in just the last week. 6.6 million applied for unemployment. So all of the job gains of the last 5 years have now been lost nationally. What does the situation look like locally, statewide?
Since March 16th, 308,814 unemployment claims have been filed in North Carolina, and all of those specifically are COVID-19 related. The actual number in North Carolina for initial claims is actually about 353,000. So the last 2 weeks of March here in North Carolina were especially devastating, and I think that we have one of the highest count of people filing in the entire country. We are heavily, we have a lot of people employed in the hospitality industry here in North Carolina. A lot of people in, the hourly jobs that are unfortunately more heavily impacted by this. So in North Carolina, checks should be coming. If people haven't started getting them, they should be getting them rather soon. When you file for unemployment in North Carolina, you will eventually also get that $600 per week unemployment benefit that the federal government has expanded. At the same time, these are all assuming that you actually get through to the unemployment office. In North Carolina, as is the case in other states, we've seen, huge backlogs, website crashes. People can't get on the phone with a live representative because these systems simply weren't built to handle this kind of demand. And they are staffing up and expanding capacity as quickly as they can, but they still don't have the resources that they need. And unfortunately, I think that means that we will continue to see new claims filed for really the foreseeable future in North Carolina.
North Carolina has some of the highest unemployment numbers per capita in the country. And I read yesterday that our unemployment numbers shot up. And this is probably a low figure because your unemployment raw figures, Katie, are higher than what I have here. But the numbers shot up 4,238%. Good Lord. In just 2 weeks. I know we're in uncharted territory here, and nobody knows exactly what's going to happen, and it's probably impossible to predict what's going to happen, and it all depends on how long all of this lasts, I suppose. But, you know, we've gone from wanting the country open by Easter and going to services on Easter to saying, well, this is going to be a little longer than that, to rising unemployment with no end in sight. And Goldman Sachs expects the economy to shrink at a record 34% in the next quarter. And I read this morning that this is going to plunge the world into a deep, long-lasting worldwide recession. Are we ready for that? Do people understand what this is going to mean? Does the government understand it? Are we being given rosier outcomes to make us feel better, or should we be looking at this more pessimistically?
I think
part of it goes back to what you said. There are no real models for what we're experiencing right now. Past recessions, past depressions, they didn't happen overnight. Except for perhaps the Great Depression happened sort of abruptly, but not nearly this abruptly. Usually, you see these things coming, and you learn that you're in recession by the time you're coming out of it, or you learn that you were in recession by the time you're coming out of it. This time, it's different. One of the other things is that, as we know, small businesses create a large percentage of the jobs in the U.S. We often think of employment as big Fortune 500 companies, but most people work for relatively small employers, and those are the companies that are going to be really impacted by this, and many of them are going to fail. So it's really impossible for us to know what the long-term impact of this is going to be.
I mean, we talked about and we've heard about big businesses being helped by the congressional stimulus package that came out. What about help for small business, those in this area, restaurants and printers and people who have 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 employees? The federal package includes $350 million in forgivable loans for small businesses that employ fewer than 500 people. And I think those loans become forgivable if they keep their employees on the payroll during this. What are the restrictions, and how do these businesses file, Katie, for this money?
It is $350 billion with a B, I must
okay,
note
excuse
that.
Me.
At the same time, you know, the maximum amount for any small business, you know, if it's a company that employs fewer than 500 people, the maximum they can apply for a loan for would be $10 million. And that can go toward things like utilities, payroll, rent, other random business expenses. And this is part of the federal government's most recent effort to relieve the economic fallout from coronavirus. It's known as the CARES Act. Again, you know, we've talked about demand with individuals filing for unemployment. The SBA is not exactly known for its track record of quickly processing such loans. So there is some concern that the SBA is not ready for the deluge of small businesses that are about to start applying for these loans. Now, at the same time, this program is unique and it is, you know, attractive for many small businesses because it effectively turns into a grant if these companies retain some employees for a certain period of time. At the same time, it's, you know, we're not sure that it, you know, solves every problem that they have because a lot of people still are not sure how to navigate this system, for instance. They don't know if this makes sense for them. They, you know, kind of need a little bit more guidance. And we're seeing from some municipalities like Atlanta, Seattle, San Francisco, the local city government stepping in and offering, you know, small business grants, assistance like small business hotlines to help entrepreneurs through this. So I think that there is certainly a need for a little bit more, but this most recent effort certainly is a step in the direction of helping out small businesses who will be adversely affected by this thing, undoubtedly.
Mike, I've talked to some state, I've talked to some local elected officials, and while we talk about what's happening federally, there will be state and local efforts to help small businesses as well. I'm told that the county and the city might be in a position to announce some programs as early as next week, perhaps. Just today, the city of Charlotte is holding a teleconference, if you will, to hear from local small businesses about what types of assistance they need. So there will be efforts here in Charlotte and in Mecklenburg County to help small businesses, especially some of those that are located on distressed corridors.
Joe.
Some of the surrounding towns and cities are also starting to step up and help their small businesses. Belmont City Council, for example, passed a $400,000 small business assistance package that will allow emergency loans up to $10,000 to help businesses in Belmont.
The first of the month is when the rent is due and when many car payments are due and when mortgage payments are due, and that was 2 days ago. And Governor Cooper has urged landlords not to proceed with evictions that have already been initiated. And here's what Kim Graham, the head of the Greater Charlotte Apartment Association, told WFAE.
I get the sense that our members are doing as much as they possibly can to be flexible and to find workarounds, because the reality is this, that evictions are very expensive to do and they don't feel good.
Is there a place, if landlords are cooperating with this request from the governor, is there a place for them to go? Because some of them have mortgages to pay and interest payments to make and, of course, taxes on the property to pay. Is there a place for them to go if they don't evict and try to find tenants who can pay?
I think that that's a conversation that I think a lot of landlords also really want to have before we brush all landlords with, you know, negative light. They do, you know, tend to not elicit as much sympathy, unfortunately, but most landlords actually need to collect rent. They have bills to pay too. This trickles up eventually to whoever their lender is, you know, be it a bank, whatever mortgage holder it might be. So I think that you might, you know, they might have to have conversations kind of above them as well, whether it's with their banks or whether it's with another, you know, credit union or something. So I think that these conversations are not just between tenants and landlords, and it's not just as easy as requesting that landlords, you know, forgive April. Again, this is not just going to be April. It's going to be also May, June, maybe July, maybe August. So we're talking about a ton of money, and tenants were not, you know, it wasn't a poor business decision that put them in this position. It wasn't, you know, some recent misstep. Everybody is in this position by no fault of their own. And most small businesses don't have the cash reserves on hand to survive for several months without any incoming or without substantial incoming revenue.
There are other interesting sidebar issues that are arising because of the epidemic that we're facing here, including a rise in the number of domestic abuse claims, which we'll talk about when we come back. We'll also talk about its impact on education and plans for voting by mail in the fall, and maybe get a little information on who is hiring, because there are some businesses out there who are hiring during all of this. It's Charlotte Talk. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and Dawes Helms is here. We'll talk about education with her, our education reporter, in a moment. Katie Peralta, senior editor of the Charlotte Agenda. Joe Bruno, reporter for WSOC-TV. And Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com. Glenn, CMPD is noticing a curious trend as this virus takes hold. Calls related to domestic disturbances have risen 18% in the last month versus the prior year. That was an increase of 517 domestic-related calls. Correct me if I'm wrong, but those numbers are before the stay-at-home order was issued. Is that right?
Not entirely, no. They were for the entire month of March. And as you know, in Mecklenburg, we started kind of hunkering down a little bit before the state order did came through. So those numbers were comparing March 2020 to March 2019.
Karen Parker heads an organization called Safe Alliance. It's an advocacy group for victims of domestic violence. And she told WFAE they've never seen anything like this before, and the demand for help has been unprecedented. Further, she believes the stay-at-home order will make things worse.
They might not have the income that they need to be able to escape an abusive relationship. And so a lot of those natural supports that people typically have in place are not in place right now.
This is not just a matter of being cooped up in an environment with somebody who irks you. This is also that people don't have a place to go if that happens, and they've lost their jobs and they've lost their social connections. So a lot of psychological things are building up. And this uptick comes at a time when her organization, Karen Parker's organization, Safe Alliance, has cut the number of beds in its shelter by 50 to provide some distancing amid this coronavirus outbreak. You report, Glenn, that CMPD has not seen a spike in overall crime, however, since this outbreak began, but there are more incidences of criminals shooting into occupied homes. That number is up 80%.
Yes, that 80% represented an additional 60 incidents in March alone. I don't know what, if anything, that might have to do with a stay-at-home order, but those were two categories of crime that kind of jumped off the charts in the month of March. Our homicide rate is roughly the same as last year. Robbery rate has been steady, but when it comes to domestic disturbances and people shooting into occupied dwellings, for whatever reason, those two categories just leaped.
Wow. We spent an hour this week with you, Anne, and others on this program talking about education in this online world now that all these school districts are in around the country. CMS started teaching online this week. How's it going?
I think you would have to ask every single family in school. Just the level of confusion, I think, was a little bit obvious when we were having that conversation, because we had a teacher from one middle school who was very well informed. And she said, we started teaching new material right away this week. And I had been out to another middle school that said, no, we're going to start next week. And CMS put out a 26-minute video yesterday afternoon, kind of talking through some of these things, and they said it's a rolling start. So some schools actually have started teaching new material and some will start next week. On that same show, she said, we assume we are giving end of year tests, end of grade and end of course tests. We are still teaching toward those. And then I went and listened to a state board meeting yesterday and they said, no, we're not going to have tests. So we have to figure out what that means for teacher bonuses and things like that. Again, there are just all these moving pieces. I thought it was interesting that what the CMS officials, sort of their little motto has become add value, do no harm, which is kind of an odd educational philosophy, but they're essentially saying we are going to do all these things we can to help you teach your kids at home, but we're going to try really hard not to penalize any child because of their family circumstances, because of what they do or don't have during this time when they don't go to school. There was a lot of concern really early on that there were going to be these huge requirements for teachers and families to essentially be online doing almost a virtual class for like 6-8 hours a day. And CMS is now trying to send the message out saying, no, we want this to be very limited, especially for the younger children. We don't want them spending all their day in front of a screen. And we do understand that our teachers are taking care of their own families as well.
There's a lot of concern, not only here, but around the country, that this online educational paradigm shift is going to really hurt those at the lower end of the scale, the socioeconomic scale, because there's already equity problems at that level, and that's going to be exacerbated by lack of access to the internet, lack of access to equipment, lack of access to an appropriate study space in the home, etc. And we had an expert on that program earlier this week from the University of California at Irvine who said this is going to set us back decades in that area. Decades. Did that surprise you?
Yeah, that was a real sort of gut punch moment for me. And I'm not exactly sure what he means by decades. I mean, obviously a child is not going to be decades behind where he was, but I do think that that child who has had the best possible support from home and that child who does not, whenever we return to classrooms, there's going to be a bigger gap between them. And what really hit me is that it drove home how much we are asking our public school educators to compensate for what kids don't get at home and for what their families don't necessarily get from society in terms of support. We have these huge gaps, and we're saying to public school teachers across this country, do what you can to make up for it.
So midterms have been canceled. What about the end of year tests and the grades that make it possible for third graders to go to fourth and eighth graders to go to ninth? Have they decided what to do about that yet?
They have not. This House panel that looked at that, I guess, last week, when they met this week, they talked about higher education. And one of the co-chairs was actually kind of scolding the other members, saying, you're not asking enough questions. You don't know how fast we have to, you're not understanding how fast we have to come up with some very serious recommendations for when the General Assembly convenes. I believe it's April 28th. Yeah. So no, a lot of those things are unsettled. And that was what the CMS video said when they asked about grades. And they said, we don't know that yet. We're waiting. You know, it's sort of hard to imagine how you assign traditional grades in this very non-traditional situation. But if we come back on May 18th and the state says you've got to assign grades, we're going to try to be ready for that.
And these grades, these end of year grades, help teachers know where they are and helps the state know, or at least grade the schools that these teachers teach in. And it also determines bonuses. And the state paid out $35 million in bonuses this year based on last year's test scores. And I think they met this week to talk about these bonuses and the impact, the effect that they're having on the quality of education. And they came up with no answer.
Yeah, it's very hard to establish that clear cut. And I looked through the data and it was very mixed. You know, basically, if you saw that bonuses somehow caused the teachers who got them to do better and or to stay longer, and there was some evidence that the teachers who got bonuses were more likely to stay, but it wasn't clear that it was because of the bonuses. So
was that the intended reason for the bonus, to incentivize teachers to do a good job in the classroom, or was it to reward them for having done a good job in the classroom?
I think at least part of the reason was that they wanted it to have an impact on students. In other words, it's not just a, hey, this is nice, you know, go out and take yourself out for a nice vacation, that it was supposed to increase the quality of education. And there have been studies that have shown that incentives like that are not very effective in that kind of thing. It may be if it's literally increasing your production on a production line or something very concrete, there may be some ability to affect behavior. But that teachers are not, for the most part, working less and will then somehow work more or better if they can get a bonus. So yeah. One of the panelists did say, and he said, we are not going to have end of grade and end of course tests. And he said that is a given, that we will not have them this year. So therefore, we can't do the bonuses next year the way we've been doing them. Let's take this time and let's really take a deep breath and do some serious research and figure out whether this is a smart way to spend that $35 million.
And you reported just 4 hours ago that North Carolina universities and colleges have gotten together with state lawmakers to talk about what they need during this outbreak. What do they need?
Boy, they are just kind of looking over the cliff and saying, okay, we know we have had to go online for the rest of this year. I believe a lot of universities are now saying their summer classes will be virtual. There are a handful of students who are still on campuses because either they can't go home or they don't have a home to go to, or they don't have a home with internet access. But if we make this kind of conversion for a long term, is it a high quality education? Is it potentially better and cheaper, or is it potentially cheaper and a lot worse? Even things like giving a refund for room and board, which the UNC system has agreed to do, it seems really sensible. But as they pointed out, we're still paying mortgages or paying on those buildings, or still paying utilities. We hope not to lay off our workers. And who do you even write that check to? Because room and board in some cases is paid by the student, in some cases by parents, in some cases by some entity that's covering their costs. So it's all very complicated. And the Association of Private Universities asked for a total of $71 million from the state. A lot of that would go to additional financial aid for their students to survive this. But some of it they were saying, look at what an impact all of these private colleges, I think there are 36 in North Carolina, they're a huge impact on the economy. We're going to be in deep trouble because this is not going to be over in May or in August or anytime soon. So, you know, provide us some stimulus in addition to what the federal government is doing, because that is out there, but it's still kind of an unknown. Again, that seems to be the theme through all of this, is we don't know what's happening, but we're pretty sure it's going to be bad.
Okay. Nine states have postponed their primaries. We're in the middle of a primary election season with the November general election coming up very quickly, and two political conventions, one of which, the Democratic convention, has been postponed till August and in Milwaukee, and moved to the week before the Republican convention here in Charlotte in August. State Elections Executive Director Karen Brinson Bell sent North Carolina lawmakers a six-page letter outlining some proposed changes she'd like to make in to make voting by mail easier in the state. What is she proposing? Anybody?
Well, I can
answer that if you'd like.
Mail easier for a mass majority of people, because there's going to be probably fewer poll workers, and people will still be discouraged from going outside and things along that nature, especially with this June 23rd second primary that's coming up for the 11th district up in Western North Carolina. Yeah,
she wants to eliminate the requirements that mail ballots be signed by two witnesses or a notary. She would only want to require one witness. She wants the state to pay the postage on back and forth mailing of these ballots. And she suggested the state make the November election day a state holiday. This would make voting easier, and our Republican-controlled legislature has a track record of trying to change the rules and processes that tend to make voting more difficult. And the state's top lawmaker, Senate Leader Phil Berger, has said he opposes these recommendations.
I understand that some progressive, liberal, Democratic groups would like to roll that back and put us back in many respects to where we were. I'm afraid that's where the elections director would take us with her proposals.
Now, these aren't just suggestions from the elections director, Karen Brinson Bell. They are being recommended by nonpartisan organizations in all 50 states. And you can listen back to our show from Monday on this very topic. We devoted an entire hour to this. Why is Phil Berger so opposed to this? What makes this liberal?
Isn't there some sort of belief that when voting becomes more accessible to the masses, that Democrats will have some undue advantage? I saw Georgia lawmakers say that yesterday. I think, you know, it sort of highlights a lot of what we already know, but I think that that's kind of the general consensus. Again, you know, having a national holiday for voting seems like a pretty straightforward way to open up access to everybody, but not everyone sees that as a good thing.
And he also told WFA.
Really hard, and I was saying the irony is really hard to miss given what just happened in North Carolina with a nine.
Well, he brought that up to WFAE. He said he doesn't want, if the state loosens its laws on mail voting, it could cause problems like what we experienced in the state's 9th congressional district and their mail ballot scandal in 2018. But that was on the Republican side.
And that's the irony. Side.
Yeah, that is the irony. So let's talk a little bit. Let's get a little good news in here, Katie. Restaurants and retailers have laid off or furloughed hundreds of thousands of people, but businesses are in fact hiring, and the Charlotte Agenda ran a list of jobs at area banks and health-oriented business and grocery stores, and not all of them appear to be low-level jobs. Some of these look like they might pay something.
Yeah, well, banks, that's a whole different beast here, because there's, you know, there's a possibility that banks could get a lot busier if they are part of the effort to support the SBA loans, or if they will be processing some of those loans. That could be a gigantic undertaking for banks. As far as other areas are concerned, I mean, elsewhere in retail, of course, grocery stores are ramping up hiring very aggressively. Harris Teeter has started paying its associates more even. I think Food Lion did that recently. Lowe's is increasing pay for store employees. Better.com, the mortgage company that moved here, I guess it was last year, is hiring laid off hospitality workers. So across the board, there are a lot of jobs in retail to be had. At the same time, not all of them are going to be these guaranteed high paying full-time jobs.
And I don't know that the furniture industry is creating jobs with this, but the furniture industry is using fabric from furniture to make masks that can, or mask covers that can be washed, and so you can use the same mask, the health workers can use the same mask over and over again, and they seem to be ramping up production of those. Katie Peralta from the Charlotte Agenda, Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV, Glenn Birkins from Q-City Metro, and Ann Doss-Helms. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.